Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. From his rapid-fire stand-up comedy riffs to his breakout role in Mork and Mindy and his Academy Award-winning performance in Good Will Hunting, Robin Williams was a singularly innovative and beloved entertainer. But as New York Times culture reporter Dave Itzkoff shows in his new biography, Robin, his comic brilliance masked a deep well of conflicting emotions and self-doubt, which he drew upon in his comedy and in his celebrated films. It is a great pleasure to welcome Dave Itzkoff to this week's Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Certainly. Thank you for having me on.
What brought you to want to write such an in-depth biography of Robin Williams not that long after his death?
Well, I mean, I had written about him on a few occasions, at the Times, and done a number of pieces either that he participated in, or in particular, there was a long profile that I wrote about him in 2009, and that was in the midst of some really tumultuous things that had happened in his life in the years past, that he had first had this relapse into alcoholism, and then went to rehab and, got clean from that. That sort of led to his divorce from his second wife, Marcia, who was really instrumental in his life and also career, and, you know, had helped him get films like Mrs. Doubtfire. And then he had tried to start that comedy tour about a year earlier and got on the road and then started having heart problems and had to have valve replacement surgery, which was pretty perilous, and then had to spend a lot of time recuperating. So all of that had happened by the time he and I got together. And my expectation in a setting like that is that people often don't want to talk about really difficult things that they've experienced on that order. And he was completely the opposite; that he was sort of relentlessly candid about all these things that had happened and wanted to discuss them. They were very much in the comedy routine that he was performing, and he talked about them, fairly sincerely in our interviews, and particularly, the alcoholism and the recovery of that. So, when you meet somebody that is that upfront about themselves and wears their heart on their sleeve that way, you really don't forget about them.
When you would have those one-on-one discussions, was he out of character?
Well, he was never. It's interesting. He, he had certainly in one-on-one settings a more subdued manner. He spoke very evenly, very softly, but he would still throw out a voice or a character bit or a joke. We would be sitting in his hotel room late at night, and the lights would start to flicker, and it was just as he had said something about, his late mother, and so he sort of pretended like it was his mother's spirit communicating with him through the lights. I think that's just how he was naturally, that the joking and the riffing was just sort of part of his vocabulary, even when he was just talking to one person.
In writing the book, well, you told the story on The Tonight Show, but you went comic book shopping with him.
Well, that was sort of I guess a fringe benefit of writing the profile of him, that in one of these on-the-record conversations, one of the interviews, we were talking about comic books, and I'd mentioned, the store that I shop in New York, and it was the same store that he said that he went to when he came to New York, and he said, "Oh, I'll take you there one day," and he actually did. He called me up, and sort of somewhat surprising, and he and I just went shopping, and I didn't take it for granted that somehow he was doing something special that only I mean, it was a very unique experience to have, but I also sort of understood that he wanted to give the Robin Williams experience to everyone, to anybody who wanted that from him. It was very important to him that people come away with that feeling of connection to him, and if he had the ability to provide that in some way, he wanted to do it. I'm sure a lot of other people that he knew had some equivalent experience to the one that I got.
You make it clear at the very beginning of the book that you were a fan, that he was one of your heroes growing up.
I sort of put that at the end. I mean, I just want people to know where I'm coming from. But I don't see how you could write a book about him without some kind of empathy, partly because of the work that he did and the way that he carried himself. And I think the kind of his goal and his desire in his work was to, I think, give joy and pleasure and catharsis to others. And I think just also the circumstances of his life. I don't see how somebody could write about him in any other way but with a kind of, you know, an appreciation and admiration for him.
Let's talk a little bit about his growing up. He was a wealthy kid growing up. He came from a Ford Motor Company executive.
Yeah. His dad was, from the Midwest, and that whole side of the family, the Williams side, they were kind of wealthy industry family. His dad was a World War II vet and then started working for Ford and, became, an executive there, kind of bounced back between, offices in Illinois and in Michigan. And on his mom's side, his mother was descended from, Southern aristocracy and a great-great-grandfather who had been, both a senator and a governor in Mississippi. So we're talking about, a fairly privileged background, which is, for stand-up comedy, somewhat unusual. But also, even though Robin grew up with friends pretty much, everywhere he lived and, all the schools that he attended. I mean, he definitely had feelings of loneliness and solitude. His dad traveled a lot for work. His mother was, very busy either with social functions of her own or organizing, dinner parties for the dad. And so, their affirmation from both of them was extremely important to him and a little hard to come by. And, he was very much into, toys and toy soldiers and, imbuing all the soldiers with, different voices and characters. And that was really kind of a training ground for, what he would end up doing on stage.
Initially, it was to be a trained actor, correct?
Oh, yeah. That was the goal, essentially, from college. I mean, he didn't, out of high school, he didn't quite know what he wanted to do. And he was sent to Claremont College in the Los Angeles area, where most people tend to study in that era to become professionals, lawyers, CEOs, that sort of thing. And just sort of by chance, he took an improvisational theater course there and really fell in love with it and excelled in that, but was totally deficient in all of his other studies and was pulled out of there. Then went to the College of Marin for a couple of years and did a lot of straight theater there, both plays and musicals. He played Fagin in a kind of renowned local production of Oliver, and then went to Juilliard for 3 years and, got the kind of elite training that they offer. Although, as beloved as he was by his teachers and as much talent as he clearly possessed, he was not an especially disciplined student, and they couldn't really beat that out of him, so to speak. And so, he was basically cut after 3 years of studies there. And, I think the feeling was mutual. He was really kind of itching to move beyond the kind of structure that they, clung to in that era.
When he burst onto the comedy scene, who were his contemporaries at that point?
There's an era where he comes back to the Bay Area and to San Francisco right after Juilliard and kind of fell into stand-up. And that's sort of the, it was the same time as people like, Don Novello, who, then became Father Guido Sarducci. But really when he, a couple of years after that, moves to L.A. to really look, for bigger opportunities, he's arriving there at the same time as Jay Leno, who became a good friend of his, and Richard Lewis. And I mean, the man that a lot of them really idolized, not a contemporary, but sort of a hero to a lot of them, was Richard Pryor, who was just absolutely, tearing it up in that period. But also, somebody who was very well known for, substance problems and, drank a lot, did a lot of cocaine. And Pryor dealt with that in his routines. I mean, he would have these, whether it was the brutal experiences of his childhood or what he was going through then, he would just kind of lay it all on the line in his shows.
What did Gary Marshall, who ultimately created Mork and Mindy, before that, of course, had created Happy Days, What did he see in Robin Williams, and how was he able to do what seemed impossible to bottle that energy and put it into a 22-minute situation comedy?
Yeah, I'm not sure that they knew quite what they had at first. I mean, people probably remember that Robin first played Mork in a kind of one-off episode of Happy Days, and he was cast really at the last minute, that they had offered that role to other sort of better-known comedians at the time, and Dom DeLuise and Jonathan Winters, and all these people passed on it, and they basically had to do a kind of, shotgun audition session and just bring in a bunch of, lower-level comedians at that time, and they were won over by Robin in the audition, but I don't think really marked him as somebody of, greater faculty at that moment. And then, they saw what he did in the episode. They saw certainly the ratings that the episode delivered. And, Marshall was in a situation where he just got a call, very late in the TV season from, his bosses saying, ABC just wants a new show from us. They don't like what they have and they need something new. Marshall sort of remembered that, Robin's episode of Happy Days had done well and said, what about a spinoff about this guy? And we'll pair him up with, an Earthling woman and they'll have a funny dynamic. And basically on the basis of that pitch, he sold the show. Then they had to figure out what that show was. But I think that just the nature of that program, it being about an alien from another world, is a little bit naive and certainly misunderstanding of Earth customs. It was so, without realizing it, kind of perfectly suited for Robin, because on the one hand, it was a platform for, again, all the improvisation, all the characters and voices and his ability to kind of, build beyond what was on the page. But also, I think, again, that strain of empathy in his work, of somebody who, coming in as a kind of an outsider or a foreigner and learning to love and appreciate his kind of adopted environment, but still having a little bit of a distance, a little bit of a remove from it. I mean, that was very, it's quite parallel to, I think, how he conducted himself in real life.
Dave Itzkoff is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new book is Robin, a biography of Robin Williams. One of the things that keeps recurring in this book is that there is a sense of happiness. There's a sense of calm. There is a sense of things are going okay. And then he behaves rashly, erratically, betrays someone's trust, and you're at the depths.
Yeah. I mean, he had, three marriages in his lifetime, and the first two both ended in divorce. And he had children with both of the first two wives, and children that he loved dearly, and really loved the wives dearly. And it's hard to pinpoint exactly, I think, where that kind of impulse came from. I mean, in some sense, he had a somewhat disruptive upbringing, that he moved around a lot because of his father's job, and particularly when his dad retired from Ford and then moved the family out to the Bay Area. That was right before Robin's senior year of high school, and he had really gotten settled in. When they were living in Michigan, and he was attending Detroit Country Day School, which is a very button-down prep school, and then he lands in San Francisco in 1969, in the sort of the tail end of the Summer of Love. Very, very disorienting to him, a real culture shock, and I think a sort of early object lesson that, you can't really get comfortable in a situation, or when things start to look stable, that's when they're most likely to be upset. And, I think he wasn't, in a lot of situations, necessarily comfortable with calm. That there was some part of him that also liked, unpredictability, uncertainty.
When you think of the years before his death, I guess one of the things that struck me in reading the book and surprised me was just how not only unhappy, I mean, there was the illness, which we'll discuss in a moment, but also his career was not going exactly, it wasn't going that great. He had a CBS series, Crazy Ones, that wasn't going well. And was it his expectation that it would?
Well, I think by the time he did The Crazy Ones, I don't think he had necessarily the highest hopes for it or thought that that was going to be, Mork and Mindy Part 2. But, on paper, it was a good proposition. It was a show that at least would, allow him again to kind of, improvise a little bit or go off the page. It was on CBS, which, certainly has a kind of brand identity for, reinventing or rediscovering, TV stars of past eras. And, it was going to be a pretty steady paycheck. It was something on the order of like, $130,000 or $150,000 an episode, which, is a really good sort of, baseline. And, in the hopes that maybe in a given year you find maybe one film role or even two that can, you can expand your horizons with. And that would be a kind of a rebuilding of his career. But the show really was not well received and just barely, lasted a season. And mostly what he was doing at that point were, independent films, which, let him play interesting characters, but obviously are not, that lucrative.
Right or wrong, could he have just gone out, gone on the road, and made a lot of money doing stand-up?
I mean, it would be hard to do, I think, every single year. He tried to do his tours, I think, a little bit more sparingly. I mean, he would do one about, maybe once every 5 or 6 years so that they felt special, that it took him time to, gather and organize the material. If he did it, they would make money, but it's a lot of effort and energy. It's really a choice. You either do the tour or you make a movie or you make a TV show. You kind of can't do all of them. But, I think he did a lot of work in that era that really pointed to the potential for another chapter in his career. He did a really terrific but sadly short-lived Broadway show called Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo, where he played a character that is, literally the ghost of a tiger that's been killed right after the U.S. Invasion of Iraq. It was a very sort of, darkly kind of comedic play, but he really was fantastic in it. He made a film for his friend Bobcat Goldthwait called World's Greatest Dad that also was, dark. But all these works really showed that I think there could have been another phase, that he could have found more pieces like this and eventually the right one for who he was at that time.
Dave Itzkoff is our guest. The name of the book is Robin. It's a biography of Robin Williams. It is published by Henry Holt. At what point do you, in researching his life, do you start to see his illness really start to impact his work and his daily life?
I mean, he was showing, I think, what retrospectively turned out to be some of these symptoms probably around 2010, 2011, and certainly by 2013, which, again, that's the period that he's making The Crazy Ones, it was much more pronounced. And the very last sort of big studio movie that he made, which was, the third, the second sequel, third entry in the Night at the Museum franchise, where he, played Teddy Roosevelt, was really, really difficult for him. That, a lot of the shooting for the film happened in Vancouver. And by that point, he was having problems with his memory and feeling like he was, forgetting his lines for the film. And, there's a story that his makeup artist, Cherie Minns, told me about how, one evening she suggested to him that maybe he try to go out to a comedy club, just make a surprise appearance, and, people would be really happy to see him. He would realize how much people loved and missed him. And, he just kind of, broke down in her arms and started crying and wouldn't do it because he said to her, "I can't be funny anymore." That by that point, he had so much, anxiety and, really just felt so out of practice and really fearful for his own physical and mental state that he didn't think he could go out in front of audiences like that anymore.
He was diagnosed, but misdiagnosed.
I mean, just to be clear, I mean, neurologists would not necessarily call it a misdiagnosis, that in his own lifetime, he was given a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, and that's based on, you know, whatever symptoms those doctors would have seen in him at the time. Parkinson's affects primarily the motor part of the brain, so that has to do with, you know, if you see, you know, a person with kind of, you know, stooped posture or, you know, rigidity in their arms and legs, that kind of thing. But it didn't come out until after his death and, you know, when his autopsy was conducted, you know, because they analyzed, you know, tissue samples from his brain. They found evidence of what's called Lewy body disease or Lewy body dementia. And it's akin to Parkinson's, but beyond just the motor parts of the brain, it also attacks, you know, the parts that are responsible for cognition and decision-making and how you process information. So the people who suffer from it, I mean, they can have, you know, really high levels of anxiety and really, you know, paranoia. They can have really kind of wild emotional mood swings. And some people that have it, you know, even have hallucinations. They do have memory problems. So he was likely experiencing a lot of those symptoms, and it's a degenerative disease. It's not curable. It, you know, it would be a terrible diagnosis to face if you knew that's what you had. To not know that that's exactly what you've got, it's hard to imagine how awful that is.
The circumstances of his death, his suicide, were, I mean, suicide is in and of itself horrific, but the nature of his suicide was horrific.
Yeah, I think it was very difficult for people to process, not only because, as you say, in and of itself, it's so terrible and tragic, but also I think, you know, the vast majority of us were not aware of what had been happening to him in the last year or so of his life. And so if your image of him is of a person who, you know, is often joyful or certainly, you know, endeavors to bring joy to other people's lives, and then this is what becomes of them, happens to them, it's very hard to reconcile those two things. It was, you know, very difficult for people to compute.
What was the reaction from, of course, there's the reaction from the world of and the surprise. You talked to a lot of his friends, and one of the things that struck me in the book is that he seemed to be, in that last year, saying goodbye to a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all people sort of seeing it, you know, retrospectively, maybe not understanding it or not realizing it at the time, but feeling like, you know, on the one hand, they felt like they were seeing him shut down, that, you know, they were seeing a kind of a physical diminishing of him and also a kind of an emotional detachment that, you know, again, in retrospect, could have been, you know, a result of the disease. You know, Billy Crystal told me a story about one of the last times that he, you know, saw Robin, where, you know, he, Billy and his wife took him out to dinner, and Robin was very, you know, quiet, you know, through the meal and just kind of seems to be, you know, looking off wistfully in the distance. And then, you know, Billy and his wife are driving home, and they keep getting calls on their phone every few minutes, and it's Robin. And he'd say, you know, he'd first be very kind of, you know, emotional and, oh, I was so happy to see you and I missed you and let's do it again. And then, you know, call back a few minutes later and I'm sorry for how, you know, emotional and gushy I was in that last call. Can you forgive me? I'm sorry. And, you know, the sort of the repetition of that, there was a neediness beyond even, you know, what, you know, how he might have normally behaved otherwise.
What do you think the legacy of Robin Williams will become?
Well, I think that, you know, he has a body of work that is, you know, unmatchable. I think what he accomplished as a stand-up comedian and as an actor in comedic films, an actor in dramatic films, there's nobody that, you know, really has, you know, a resume like that. I mean, I know, you know, people use the word genius to describe him, and it's not just because of, you know, how quick-witted he was, how inventive he was, but really that, you know, there's nobody that did what he did before him, and there doesn't seem to be a way that anybody could have a career quite like his since.
The name of the book is Robin, and it is published by Henry Holt. Dave Itzkoff, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you for having me on.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Thanks to Paul Ruest and Argo Studios in Manhattan for production support. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.